There are many lenses through which we can understand American culture: political debates, economic fluctuations, military engagements, social movements, key historical actors, and more. What my own disciplinary background, literary study, brings to an examination of American culture is the question of narrative. In other words, what kind of stories do we as Americans choose to tell about ourselves? What do the themes, patterns, and emphases of those stories tell us about how we are engaging with the world around us, how we hope to shape it, change it, or defend ourselves against it? The particular lens I have chosen in this process of reading American culture is that of gender. By gender, I mean those structures that define a set of expectations for how men and women should behave as men and women. In particular, I have been interested in how a study of representations of gender in popular culture illuminates significant dynamics in American culture, not only in terms of how individual men and women are portrayed, but more broadly, how the symbolic characteristics associated with men and women, strength, sensitivity, aggressiveness, deception, and so on, shape cultural values, interactions, and decisions. The dynamic movements of definitions and constructions of gender shift with the multiple and complex social interactions that shape any historical moment. However, because the constructions of gender are linked in intimate and profound ways to social, political, economic, and cultural activities, I believe that tracing those changing definitions of gender, and of masculinity in particular, is one of the key windows through which we can examine any historical period. I hope this evening to describe one of those windows, the constructions of masculinity through images of fathers and sons, and to use that framework to examine the symbolic affiliates that accompany those images, questions of continuity, power, rebellion, protection, and then to use those insights to comment on cultural narratives in an environment of terrorism. In particular, I want to use this framework to talk about American culture after September 11th. Before I do so, let me step back for a minute to paint a larger picture of the kind of conversation I would like to have this evening. I will begin with a brief discussion of the broader global context within which I think these narratives are working. I will then turn to a discussion of popular narratives about terrorism. Following this, I will look at some popular films after September 11th and then close with a broader discussion of the implications of September 11th for American culture. Cultural geographer Neil Smith describes what he calls a spatial turn that took place at the end of the 19th century, in which an American view of space as local and regional shifted to a view of space as international and imperial. According to Smith, this shift accompanied and enabled the development of U.S. imperialism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Smith suggests that another turn is taking place at the end of the 20th century, one that configures American perceptions of space in relation to global politics and economics, in which location is defined in and through access to technologies and capital markets. This turn accompanies and enables what has come to be known as globalization. Such shifts did not and cannot take place in isolation, but in conjunction with a myriad of interdependent shifts. In particular, the spatial turn that we are witnessing now, like that of the early 1900s, is occurring simultaneous with a shift in the constructions of gender, more specifically, the constructions of masculinity. The forms of white masculinity, historically affiliated with and constructed to benefit from the structures of power that are articulated through those spatial definitions. And because white men have historically benefited from the interconnections of capital, space, and power, they are simultaneously positioned both to profit again from the shifts that are taking place as globalization and to be most at risk in losing ground as that shift takes place. As I have described in other contexts, because of the close affiliations between the organizations of masculinity, space, and power, the changing economic structures of the 1980s, 1990s, and the first year of this century have led to substantial shifts in the definitions and arenas of masculine authority. As the definitions of masculinity that held sway during the Cold War security paradigm came to be altered with the end of the Cold War, a profound crisis in masculinity became a focal point, not only of popular narratives, but of political ones as well. Into this arena came many competing and contradictory models of masculinity, ranging from Robert Bly's rediscovery of male mythologies to the Promise Keepers' reaffirmation of the man as head of the household, to white supremacist narratives propagated by the white Aryan nation, to models of passionate conservatism put forward by the Bush administration. At the same time, traditional male employment models were being restructured as the United States moved from an industrialized to a service economy. And as global influence came to be identified more with economic than territorial authority, the grounding of masculinity and any foundational notions of America swept away. This is precisely the subject of my talk this evening, the intimate connections between what has come to be called globalization, spatial restructuring, masculinity, and what it means to be American. What I want to suggest here is that examinations of shifting representations of masculinity can provide insights not only into the changing gender relations to which we are witness, but to the reconfigurations of space and location that defines the shift from more localized, nationally based forms of capital to the more interlinked and globally based forms of economic transaction. By looking at the articulations of white masculinity that are being rejected and those that are being offered in their place, we can trace the rationalizations of the new narratives of global culture. One of the key locations for examining these shifts is precisely who and what is being defined as a threat to this new culture and what terrors await those who dream of challenging it. All of these anxieties and concerns became exacerbated on September 11, 2001, with the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Many Americans agree with columnist Andrew Sullivan's comments in the New York Times magazine on September 23rd, when he said, quote, "We also know somewhere that things will never be the same, that the inviolable might of this country's promise has been assaulted by an enemy whose war has just begun," unquote. A New York Times article on September 8th of this year began with the declaration that, quote, "There is near universal agreement that September 11th changed America," unquote. And while many would articulate those changes in different ways, increased patriotism, a slower pace of life, a focus on friends and family, few seem prepared to argue with Sullivan's concluding phrase in his essay, quote, "Another world began that day," unquote. What does this mean for the question I posed earlier, what does it mean to be American? There are numerous dimensions to answering this question, but if we return to the lens I identified at the beginning of this talk, a focus on gender and masculinity in particular, then any answer to this question about what, if anything, changed after September 11th could be answered through a critical gender analysis of the causes of those changes, terrorism. How are we talking about terrorists? Who are they, and why exactly are we afraid of them? In order to begin, let me summarize briefly how terrorists were talked about before September 11th in American culture. Popular narratives about terrorism began to appear with some frequency in the 1980s, focusing throughout the 80s and early 90s largely on non-American antagonists. The most typical countries of origin were nations of the Middle East, China, and Russia. By and large, the forms of terrorist activity focused on bombs, high-tech weaponry, and the assassination of key world leaders. With the exception of narratives about China, these terrorist activities were led by individual figures who had a variety of personal and political motivations behind their actions. These terrorists were most often defeated by individuals or leaders of highly trained teams who themselves challenged the bureaucracies that seemed to impede the successful capture of terrorists. Think here of any Tom Clancy novel, the novels of Stephen Kuntz, all of these best-selling, turned into films, and so on. Films such as Lethal Weapon 2, Die Hard, many more. Because I have earlier discussed some of the specific gender characteristics of the action narratives of this period, I'm going to skip over that at this point and kind of move into a more recent phase. Much of what characterized these narratives of terrorist stories changed in 1995 with the recognition that white American males were responsible for what was, until that time, the worst terrorist attack in U.S. history. Coming on the heels of an increasing national awareness of far-right militia movements that often focused on anti-government white supremacist ideologies and advocated violent actions to further these ideas, the bombing of the Alfred R. Murrah Building in Oklahoma City in 1995 crystallized a national awareness of white male violence. The men involved in these militias and who comprised the predominant membership of terrorist groups in this country were largely white, working class, and very often affiliated with rural areas. With shifting economic structures, deindustrialization, a decreasing power of unions to protect working class jobs, and the exportation of many jobs to other countries, the status of working class white men has declined visibly in recent decades. And with that decline has come an increase in anger and bitterness over what sociologist Patricia Hill Collins has called the expected inheritance of stable, well-paying, skilled labor employment. Between 1995 and 2001, many terrorist narratives focused on precisely this new category of white American men, men who are in many ways seen as very average white men. They are men who have failed to find a place in the system, men who feel overlooked, left out, or unappreciated. In contrast to the earlier terrorist narratives, the method of attack in these stories is less often the sophisticated techno-weaponry that characterized foreign terrorists and is instead the less visible and more threatening forms of germ warfare, bombings, and in some extreme cases, the eradication of almost all life on Earth. These are thriller narratives. Most interestingly, while many of the antagonists of these narratives are average white men, so are the heroes who stop them. As in the films of the 1980s, the line that separates these men is less often one of appearance, wealth, family, happiness, or personal qualities than it is one of a commitment to a core sense of values that includes not only love of country, but also dedication and a willingness to sacrifice the self for the good of a set of principles or people. Let me now turn to some of the narratives that appeared since September 11th and try to outline their messages. One of the first films to appear after September 11th that had a relationship to those events was Arnold Schwarzenegger's film Collateral Damage. The film was delayed in its release date because its topic, a terrorist bombing of the Colombian consulate in Los Angeles, and its hero, a firefighter, seemed far too close in subject matter to the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon. The film's plot is fairly straightforward, and in the pattern of the kind of action films that made Schwarzenegger famous. Arnold Schwarzenegger plays a Los Angeles firefighter who witnesses his wife and son being killed by a terrorist bomb. Though he at first relies on the US government to bring the self-identified perpetrators to justice, when he hears his family and other victims of the attack being referred to as collateral damage, hence the title of the film, he decides to take matters into his own hands, as he does in every film. What follows are the staples of action films: explosions, chase scenes, murder attempts, and a confrontation between the hero and the villain. The film, which was finally released in February of this year, fared poorly at the box office and received some criticism from people who felt that its use of a firefighter as a protagonist was, quote, an insult to the firefighters who became heroes after the terrorist attacks, unquote. Of the many reviews of the film, Roger Ebert's was one of the most interesting. At the end of the review, he declared that, because of the effects of September 11th on American culture, quote, there will not be any more action stories like this for a long time. We're at the end of the tunnel, the light is out, the genre is closed, unquote. If so, then what kinds of films are resonating with American audiences instead? What kinds of stories are being told about terrorism, and how, if at all, have they changed? Perhaps most importantly, what kind of stories are being told about terror, about what we fear, and about how we are facing those fears? There are, of course, many different kinds of stories that have been told since September 11th. There are stories of evil, of heroism, of community, of punishment, of racism, of courage, and of fear. They are stories about nations in conflict, about presidential leadership, about religious fanaticism, about the global trade in arms, and about the global trade in oil. But beyond the stories about political conflicts, military strategies, and international negotiations, beyond, in other words, the wealth of facts and information available to all of us on the news and the internet, there is the power of stories to affect us emotionally, to act out before our eyes the threads of morality, and to test for us our definitions of humanity. It was almost 20 years ago that literary critic Janice Radway taught us an important lesson about understanding how narratives affect readers. She studied women who read romance novels. And it was a wonderful study because, first, very few people had ever studied women readers of anything. Very few people had studied romance novels. And what she found in the process of interviewing women who were in these romance book clubs is that what she thought was initially a contradiction, because she would go to these women and say, well, why do you love these books so much? At the end, the woman always gets married and she has to basically subject herself to some guy and he becomes the, you know, sort of the authority in the book. And why do you like that ending? And the women would say, who cares about the ending? During the middle of the book, these women are powerful, they're strong, and they get these guys to listen to them and pay attention to them. And what Radway learned from this was, it's not always the ending of the story that matters. It's how the story unfolds. It's what we feel as we read the story. And it was an incredibly powerful insight, I think, that she taught us about how these books are read. How many of us, for instance, have had the same experience, whether with romance novels, action thrillers, or horror films? How many times, for instance, are we truly surprised by an ending? Why, if so, would they be called surprise endings, after all? Our enjoyment of narrative is more deeply focused on precisely how the story works and not so much on what the story is. If we were actually interested in what the story is, for instance, would Sylvester Stallone or Jean-Claude Van Damme have a career? It is here that the affective components of narratives are created. Consequently, we need to find ways to capture and understand that affect. This is done not so much by looking at the topic per se, but by looking at how a topic is presented and what emotions it invites readers and viewers to feel. The thesis I want to propose this evening is that one of the key ways to think about how American audiences have responded to September 11th is through the lens of gender that I mentioned earlier. In particular, I want to look at relationships between fathers and sons. There are a number of reasons why this particular framework seems a useful one to me. First and foremost, because Western history has been almost exclusively the history of patriarchal cultures. The struggles between fathers and sons have comprised some of the key references for all of Western culture. Greek mythology, Christianity, European monarchies, the treatment of slaves and peasants, the legal definitions of property, these are but a few of the arenas that have revolved around the relationships between fathers and sons. Relationships that have defined wars, class systems, colonial expansion, and more. The broadness and generality of such a statement does not help in understanding why such a framework would be of greater value now than at any other time, but precisely because this is a framework that is generally available, it's important to look at the specific usages and permutations of a story that is told time and again in different cultural moments. The second reason why I wish to focus on this relationship is that it is an emotionally powerful one, and one that provides the framework for a variety of scenarios, ranging from rebellion to submission, from independence to enslavement, from heritage to revolution, or from education to deprivation. And while many would argue that relationships between mothers and children are equally important cultural icons, Mother Nature, the mother country, the dynamics are not the same, nor, in other words, are they dynamics that revolve, as these do, around issues of power and powerlessness, the very issues that lie at the heart of American thinking about terrorism. And finally, stories about fathers and sons are stories about continuity. Whether passing on a business, a set of skills, or a name, relationships between fathers and sons are about inheritance, about connection between the past and the future, about a promise of how the future will look. Such stories speak to concerns about continuity and fears of discontinuity, and reflect senses of how stable and confident we feel about the future. In order to get a sense of why I see this as an important framework for thinking about a post-September 11th world, let me look back a few decades at a few key films that show examples of what I'm talking about. If we get the first clip, I'm keeping my fingers crossed the film quality when you blow it up this big is not as good as we would like.
We're all downstairs, Ben, waiting to see you.
Dad, can you explain to them that I have to be alone for a while?
These are all our good friends, Ben. Most of them have known you since, well, practically since you were born. What is it, Ben?
I'm just...
worried?
Well...
about what?
I guess about my future.
What about it?
I don't know.
anything wrong?
No, no. We're just on our way downstairs.
The Carlsons are here.
They are. Well, come on.
They came all the way from Tarzana. Come on, let's get cracking.
It's a wonderful thing to have so many devoted friends.
Hey, there's the award-winning scholar.
We're all very proud of you, Ben.
Thank you, Mrs. Carlson.
Is that the new car out there, that little red whop
truck? That's Ben's graduation.
Well, you won't have much trouble picking up on that, will you?
Sir.
The girls, the chicks, the teeny boppers.
Oh, I think Ben's gotten beyond the teeny bopper stage, haven't you, Ben?
Yes, ma'am. Excuse me, honey, I'd just like to check something on the car for a minute.
His father bought him an Alfa Romeo. You know what that is?
Hey, here's the track star. How are you, track star?
Just fine, Mr. Loomis.
I want to get a drink. Then I want to hear all about that thing that you won, that Hopperman Award.
Helping him.
Helping him. Right. You wait right here.
Dan! We're all so proud of you.
Proud, 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 proud.
What are you going to do now?
I was going to go upstairs for a minute.
Oh, I meant with your future.
Your life.
Well, that's a little hard to say.
Ben.
Excuse me. Mr. McGuire.
Ben.
Mr. McGuire.
Come with me for a minute. I want to talk to you. Excuse us, Joanne.
Of course. Yes.
Oh, he is
congratulations.
Such
just wonderful. I look at him and I can't believe it.
I simply can't believe it.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
Sure. Enough said. That's a deal.
Here he is now.
There are probably few one-word lines as famous in movie history as plastics. In the 1960s, The Graduate typified a generation of rebellion against the politics and values of the 1950s and was emblematic of a larger social movement that spanned but was not limited to the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. Benjamin Braddock, played here by, of course, Dustin Hoffman, became an icon of the era. Benjamin is, as the film's tagline tells us, a little worried about his future. One thing he is certain of, however, and it's a certainty that constitutes the film's primary motivation, is that he does not want to be like his father or any of the men of his father's generation. As he says, I want to be different. One of the film's most memorable quotations, the single evocative word plastics, symbolizes the quality ascribed to the previous generation's lifestyles and values. In a series of films that revolve almost entirely around the relationships between fathers and sons, Francis Ford Coppola showed us a decade later that the legacies of fathers were nearly impossible to escape. Can we get the second one?
I told you I can have.
Anyway, I'm thinking more.
It's good for you, Papa.
Your wife and children, are you happy with them?
Very happy.
That's good. I hope you don't mind the way I keep going over this Bassini business.
No, not at all.
It's an old habit. I spend my life trying not to be careless. Women and children can be careless, but not men. How's your boy?
He's good.
You know, he looks more like you every day.
He's smarter than I am. 3 years old, he can read the funny papers.
Reads the funny papers. I want you to arrange to have a telephone man check all the calls that go over. You're not able.
I did it already, Pop.
You know, good man.
Pop, I took care of that.
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
What's the matter? What's bothering you? I'll handle it. I told you I can handle it. I'll handle it.
I knew that Santana was gonna have to go through all this. And Fredo. Fredo was. And I never wanted this for you. I worked my whole life. I don't apologize to take care of my family. And I refused to be a fool. Dancing on the string, held by all those big shots. I don't apologize, that's my life, but I thought that. But when it was your time, that you would be the one to hold the strings. Senator Corleone. Governor Corleone, something.
I'm not a peasant of Anta.
This wasn't enough time, Michael. Wasn't enough time.
The son that Vito Corleone tried to protect from his mafia business gets drawn into and then assumes the control of the very family he was raised to reject. As the devastating national impact of the Vietnam War literally came home, the 1970s was a decade that realized that a son's rebellion didn't enable him to evade the consequences of his father's actions. In this, the message of The Godfather captured the painful self-image of the decade: there are no innocent sons. With the presence in the White House of one of the most fatherly presidents of the 20th century and his reclamation of concepts of nationalism and national power, films of the 1980s offered American audiences a set of images that reinforced the philosophies and politics of the Reagan era. In a series of three films, the Star Wars trilogy took fathers and sons into the fantasy world of science fiction to create a new pattern for these narratives. Unlike The Godfather, where the son was unable to escape the father's past, Star Wars and its sequels showed us that not only could sons escape that past, they could rescue their fathers from it as well. Can we get the third one? We have a lot of high-tech technology, and the tape's not working well. I'm sorry. I suspect you may remember the scene where basically Luke ends up saying to his father, I want to take you out of here. I want to save you. And he says, you already have. In a series of films replete with actual fathers, father figures, and father surrogates, Star Wars worked through the variety of permutations on this theme and arrived at a happy ending in which the father and his destructive past could be redeemed. What came to be called the Reagan era rejected the failures of Vietnam by rebuilding and reaffirming militarism as a national philosophy and by evoking a national attitude and set of values that harkened back to a time before that war and its effects on American society. Perhaps even more blatantly, the trilogy of Back to the Future films show not only that the unpleasant consequences of the father's behavior could be corrected, but that the very success of the future depended on it. When Marty McFly returned to the past and taught his father how to be a hero and not a wimp, he not only made his father a better man, but changed his family's future as well. And I don't know if we dare try another one. Maybe not. Sorry. But you may remember the great scene in Back to the Future. You've all seen it, right? Where basically he has to go back to the past and teach his father how to be a bully and beat up an aggressive bully in town in order to win his mother's love. Back to the Future showed that better than any other film that the father's reclamation was important not only to his own well-being but to the communities as a whole. By becoming a stronger man, George McFly transformed himself from being a low-wage repairman to a best-selling science fiction author, in the process changing his family's status from declining working class to upper middle class. During a decade that witnessed the growing disparity between the rich and the poor, the Back to the Future film showed that communal economic success hinged upon rewriting history and events that led to the present circumstances. There are a series of other films that it would be fun to talk about here that fit into this mentality. The Terminator, of course, and the most illogical father-son combination, where, of course, the son is the father of the son. It's just so complicated that no one can really figure it out. If you trace it, it's not logical. Nonetheless, films like The Terminator showed us that, again, these relationships determined how the entire future was going to be preserved. We see the same pattern in films such as Wall Street, Indiana Jones, the entire series, Regarding Henry, or even my own favorite, Field of Dreams. With the end of the Cold War and a rethinking of the driving definitions of American culture, this more inward turn that the nation took was reflected in a rediscovery of family and heritage. I hope that this brief summary and unfortunate film clip suggests the points that I began with a few moments ago, that the shifting narratives about fathers and sons and the dynamics that occur between them can serve as an informative mechanism for understanding American culture. In such a framework, it's useful to see what recent films about fathers and sons can tell us about American culture in the post-September 11th period. While there are a number of films that are insightful here, two are especially important: Sam Mendes' Road to Perdition and M. Night Shyamalan's Signs. Though from two different genres, crime and science fiction, and two very different directors, these films share a common theme. Both films revolve around a father's protection of his sons and children. In this way, they differ substantially from the films that we just looked at, in which rebellion against or reclamation of the father was the principal plot motivation for the son's roles. In these films, fathers are both struggling with troublesome pasts from which they are trying to shield their children. Most importantly, both pasts revolve around issues of moral belief and values. In Road to Perdition, Michael Sullivan, played by Tom Hanks, has devoted his adult life to serving as a hitman for a mob boss who became a surrogate father to him. In Signs, Graham Hess has resigned as a minister when he lost his wife and then his faith in God in a car accident. The films also share the similarity that they feature two of Hollywood's top male stars, Tom Hanks and Mel Gibson, both acting in styles atypical for their careers, both in roles that require them to be taciturn, severe, and disapproving, from actors who cut their teeth on films like Big and Lethal Weapon. Road to Perdition is the story of a son, Michael Sullivan Jr., who witnesses his father's business, killing people. Because he has seen too much, the son of the mob boss, who is jealous of the love his father shows for Sullivan Sr., kills the wife and the youngest son in the family, intending to kill the son as well as a witness. As a result, Michael Sullivan Sr., played by Tom Hanks, sets out to protect his son the only way he knows how, through violence. After a series of dramatically dark and violent scenes, Sullivan Sr. is killed, the last murder that is witnessed by his son. However, in the process, he has protected his son, found him a new, loving surrogate home, and left him enough money to grow up comfortably. In the end, a son who saw his father as mysterious and distant comes to love him unquestioningly and to believe, as the film's closing line tells us, that his father was a good man. Signs, in stark contrast, is the story of aliens arriving on Earth. And while this may not be unusual fare for Hollywood, What makes the film distinctive is Shyamalan's choice to tell this story from the almost claustrophobic viewpoint of a single family farm in rural Pennsylvania. While television scenes show that aliens have landed all around the planet, the camera remains fixed on the Hesses, a family who is already traumatized by the death of their wife and mother. In a film replete with homage to classic filmmakers, the family manages to defeat the aliens when they discover that common drinking water acts like acid on the alien skin. In the movie's climactic scene, the father saves his son's life by resuscitating him after a severe asthma attack. In the process, he saves not only his son's life, but his own faith as well. What makes these films so suggestively powerful is not simply that they provide interesting and familiar plot lines or about the relationships between fathers and sons, is that these films are surprisingly moral as well. The plots are motivated by the father's ability to protect their sons from danger. This is nothing new in Hollywood. Nor are there emphases on gunfights and alien invasions, very remarkable either. What propels these films is their unrelenting pressure to use the threat to the sons' lives to reveal the father's moral definitions. Both of these fathers have made mistakes, whether in the physical or spiritual realm. They come to terms with those mistakes and reveal their own faith in a set of values that are missing from the communities that surround them. And in doing so, they become heroic. Why do I find these films so interesting? They are, without much elaboration, allegories for American culture after September 11th. Both Michael Sullivan Sr. and Graham Hess embodied the dilemmas faced by the nation as a whole. First, there was a recognition that serious crimes had been committed in the past, even if they could be explained as the necessary work that had to be done to keep order in a militarized world. For example, no matter how firmly most American citizens believed in the need to isolate Saddam Hussein and Iraq from world commerce, few would condone the deaths of Iraqi children that have resulted from the U.S. blockade against that nation. At the same time, the crisis in faith that caused Graham Hess to renounce his ministry typified a crisis in faith in the exceptionalism of the American nation. In the same way that Graham Hess knew that evil existed in the world but couldn't understand why it happened to him, Americans were well aware that violence and terrorist attacks occurred elsewhere but were dumbfounded that they would occur here, often asking naively, why don't they like us? As if these events were an episode of high school jealousy. The fact that both narratives showed the fathers successfully confronting their past and redeeming themselves by protecting their sons affirms the ability of Americans to redeem themselves from their past and recover their faith in themselves and their nation. Most importantly, they do so precisely by protecting their sons, suggesting that an acceptance of redemption and a forgiveness for past sins may well be the cost that children have to pay for that protection. As Roger Ebert says in his review of Perdition, the movie's plot asks whether it is possible for fathers to spare their sons from the cost of their sins. The answer to the relief of movie audiences across the country is a resounding yes. And American audiences are responding to these Hollywood messages in near record numbers. Theaters sold nearly 1.5 billion tickets last year, the highest number in 42 years. In a year when other industries suffered serious setbacks, the film business thrived. As Jack Valenti, CEO of the Motion Picture Association of America, put it, quote, going to the movies is the American remedy for the anxieties of daily life, unquote. Just as they were in the Depression and World War II, the most profitable years in Hollywood history. And though the initial prediction that audiences would shy away from violent films was proved untrue with the success of Black Hawk Down, it's also the case that 17 of the top 20 films of the last year were not rated R. All of the top 10 are G, PG, or PG-13 films. Here are the key questions then that arise in this situation. How long will this imagery last? What will its long-term effects on the constructions of U.S. identity and masculinity be? Has the spatial turn Divine My Smith been altered in the wake of September 11th? Let me outline a few observations here. This turn by American audiences towards family and fantasy films might affirm Roger Ebert's claim that, quote unquote, the genre is dead when he talked about collateral damage, and confirm statements that America has fundamentally changed since September 11th. In spite of the immediate post-September 11th predictions that things will never be the same, it is difficult to identify how the country significantly has changed. As security analysts Daniel Benjamin and Stephen Simon put it, quote, whether it was because the total damage was not that extensive or because the event caused a cognitive overload, America shrugged off the attacks of September 11th. The dead were mourned and a short war was fought. But the business of government and the business and of business went on with remarkably little change, unquote. So what's going on here? There's a sense that everything has changed and that little has changed, that we know who our enemies are, but that we can't recognize them, that we know we are fearful of attacks, but we don't know why anyone would want to attack us. Uncertainty and anxiety are, of course, logical responses to September 11th. But let me suggest something else here, that uncertainty and anxiety were increasing long before September 11th of 2001, and that what we are witnessing now in the way of comforting popular culture is about more than fears about terrorist attacks. While the events of September 11th do not, in and of themselves, constitute an explanation for the economic and social restructuring that is going on in this country, they can provide a focal point for anxieties and a set of explanatory devices, largely falling under the heading of what has come to be called patriotism. A recent Pew Research Center report on global attitudes concludes that though, quote, people in the West express more satisfaction with their lives than do those in emerging nations, this pattern is reversed when respondents are asked about the future of their nation's children. Asians in particular are much more optimistic about prospects for the next generation than are Americans or Europeans, unquote. And this is why I look to films like Road to Perdition and Signs, because they aren't films about terrorism, but about terror. They aren't films about identifiable and defeatable enemies, but films about reassurance and protection. And they are films that reaffirm the continuation of a future that looks very much like the present. Let's go back to Neil Smith's idea of a spatial shift. If Smith is correct, and I think he is, then we are witnessing a much broader shift in cultural thinking in this country, one that is adjusting to more far-reaching effects than terrorist attacks, effects such as deindustrialization, a changing world economy, the growing gap between the wealthy and the poor, and a simultaneously decreasing gap between there and here. In such a context, September 11th becomes less an event that changes American culture than what we call in English classes an objective correlative, something that symbolizes a particular emotion. In this sense, September 11th served to crystallize pre-existing but nebulous fears and gave us something and someone to be afraid of. We hang our hats on the feelings generated by September 11th because they are familiar ones. They are the fears that match both our cultural history of defining external enemies and the narratives about terrorism that were widespread before September 11th. On September 24th, Anthony Lane reminded us that much of the immediate reaction to the attacks was shaped by our experiences of movies. It was, he says, the television commentators, as well as those on the ground, who resorted to a phrase book called from cinema. It was like a movie. It was like Independence Day. It was like Die Hard. No, Die Hard 2, Armageddon. Film critics David Sterrett talked about the relationships between films and September 11th in more direct terms when he said, more troubling is the thought that public views of retaliation, revenge, and warfare may come more from decades of popular entertainment than from sustained reflections on history and morality. As a way to clarify the symbolic value of September 11th, let me ask this question. Why did we not have the same kind of widespread cultural response to the Oklahoma City bombing? It is not, I would insist, because of the numerical differences in the death toll. Oklahoma City was the single greatest terrorist attack on American soil until September 11th, and yet it did not draw anything like the responses we have seen. Nor is it that the movement of which Timothy McVeigh was a part does not continue to threaten U.S. citizens. For example, the Christian Patriot movement that spawned Timothy McVeigh has not ceased activities. Montana David Burgett was arrested earlier this year with a stockpile of machine guns, bombs, and ammunition that he and others planned to use to attack police and a National Guard unit in the hopes of sparking a nationwide revolt against the federal government, all to return the country to the hands of white Christians. Little national attention was given to these events. At roughly the same time, the arrest of five U.S. citizens in Lackawanna, New York, who are accused of being part of an al-Qaeda terrorist cell, has received front page coverage, even though FBI Director Robert Mueller admitted at the time that there was no evidence that the men were planning any attacks. We have responded more forcefully to September 11th, I think, because the Oklahoma City attack, as devastating as it was, did not function in the same way to focus anxieties and fears about what is the principal concern of the spatial shift we're talking about, the changing status of the United States in the rest of the world. The threads of racial and religious profiling run throughout these stories, but there is more at work here. Philosopher Susan Neiman, in her exploration of evil, concludes that, quote, it's often said that we long for lost heroes, but our need for the right kind of villain is no less urgent. We long for a picture of what went wrong in the world, unquote. And this, finally, is what I think September 11th has provided for us as a cultural event, and why that event has riveted our attention so powerfully. Because, unlike Oklahoma City, the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon provide a more understandable and more familiar picture of what went wrong in the world. And they do so precisely because it's a picture we've seen before. It's a picture that is not only familiar, but simpler. And that simplicity, I believe, is dangerous. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Thomas Friedman wrote in this past weekend's New York Times, "We are on the edge of a transforming moment for America in the world. If President Bush uses his enormous mandate to prepare for war, there is a decent chance we can win at a reasonable cost. But if Mr. Bush simply uses his mandate to drive a hard right agenda and indulge in more feel-good politics, the world will become increasingly dangerous for every American." And as the security analysts I mentioned earlier, Benjamin and Simon, tell us, Americans must assume they will be attacked again. In such a context, stories that make us feel better, make us feel more secure, make us feel as if someone will be there to take care of us, may be comforting, but they are not wise. Let me conclude by mentioning one more film. In 1998, Edward Zwick directed a film called The Siege, a film about a Middle Eastern terrorist cell bombing buses, theaters, and schools in New York City. When the FBI and police are unable to stop the bombings, the president declares martial law and sends the army to New York. Working exclusively on a system of racial profiling, the army rounds up all young Arab men and places them in pens in Shea Stadium. The film was widely protested by Arab American groups who argued that the film propagated the kind of stereotypes that constituted the first response efforts in Oklahoma City, when, of course, the original people who were being searched for were Arab Americans or Middle East descent people. But this is precisely why a film like The Siege is important. It took the simplistic stereotypes of Oklahoma City and complicated them. Most significantly, it complicated them by showing that the terrorists who attacked New York City had been trained by the CIA in efforts to destabilize Saddam Hussein's government. They turned against the United States only when the U.S. government abandoned them to be slaughtered by the Iraqi government. The film also showed the consequences of abdicating civil rights in the face of terror. And it did this through the story of FBI agent Frank Haddad, whose son was picked up by the army and interned in Shea Stadium. The film closes when Haddad is reunited with his son after the FBI succeeds in identifying the terrorists. I don't believe that this film would be made today. If Hollywood is taking steps such as erasing the World Trade Center from film images, and I don't know, there are numerous examples of this. The most famous of them, of course, is that there was supposed to be a scene in the Spider-Man film where Spider-Man swung between the two towers. And they cut that, along with many other images. If this is the nature of their response, then a film like The Siege would not be seen as a moneymaker. But more to the point, this is a complex story about U.S. responsibility for terrorism, about racial profiling, about the deterioration of civil liberties. It is not the simpler kind of story that many Americans seem to want to hear right now, or that seems to be most readily available. A reading of American culture through the lens of gender brings us, then, to see some of the ways in which familiar and comforting narratives, such as fathers protecting sons, can be damaging, not only to our understanding of the events that have transpired in the last 15 months, but to our willingness to address some of the serious issues that lay behind those events. Stories about enemies, about heroes, about protection, and about safety may provide short-term comfort for audiences, but they will not help us to develop long-term solutions to the complex world that we're facing.